Under the Banner of Heaven here on Post Show Recaps. My name is Grace. I'm here with my co-host, Billy. Billy, how you doing?
I am good, Grace. I'm fired up to be under the banner of heaven with you. It's going to be quite a journey.
I am excited. Under the Banner of Heaven, a new Hulu original show. Andrew Garfield, potentially his acting finale or the last thing he does before he goes on a long acting break, Philly?
Yeah, I heard this madness after I watched this first episode. As we decided that we were going to talk about it. And this is insanity. This is pure insanity. Man's at the top of the world. They're like desperate to get him back in a Spider-Man costume again. He's under the banner of heaven with the Avatar guy. I mean, there's all kinds of stuff happening here, Grace. This is madness. I don't believe it.
Yeah, I don't know. He says apparently he would like to take a little break, which makes
feels
sense,
like but... a hype machine to me. It like harkens back to the days of Joaquin Phoenix's retirement. Ooh. And reemergence with the beard, with the Dave Letterman beard, with the Philly beard, maybe.
Yeah. Apparently the other day he might have come out and said he's not retiring. He's just maybe taking a break, but I mean, he's been in a lot of stuff. He was obviously, if I'm spoiling this for you now, I'm so sorry, but I don't know where you've been. He was in Spider-Man No Way Home. He was also in Tick, Tick, Boom, which he got nominated for last year, and he was also in The Eyes of Tammy Faye, which was an Oscar nominated film, although he was not nominated for his performance. But he's in a lot of stuff. He's a big deal last year. He might have had the best year.
Isn't that the technical term for it, Grace? He's hot right now.
And he wants to cool off a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, more power to him to like know when to like, you know, take a break and like recharge for yourself. I'm like being very hyperbolic, but as a person that's like in a vaguely creative space, like, yeah, go do what you need to do, Andrew Garfield, because like you're doing good stuff to that point. Like, I really like what he's doing here on television. Under the banner of heaven.
Yeah, I'm gonna get a little. Like, I'm off track already, but the only other person, the other person
don't
that I
say, Grace.
The other person I thought had a very, very good 2021 was actually Willem Dafoe, who was in a movie you and I talked about, The Northman. That is a 2022 movie, but last year he was also in Spider-Man: No Way Home. He was in Nightmare Alley, The Card Counter, and The French Dispatch. He had an incredible 2021.
He exploded back into our lives in a way that we desperately needed. For anybody who has not seen The Norseman, you should go check it out. It's very cool. Grace and I spoke about it with Ariel. It was a very good time. And Willem Dafoe's character is just wild. It's wild. Yeah. And The Lighthouse is like not that long ago either, right? I mean, like he's been killing it.
Yeah, he loves these. Like none of those movies, he is the star. He's not the star in any of those movies.
What about, we're on this tangent, Grace. Now you're going to have to get a crowbar to get me off. What about Christopher Walken? Who another film that we talked about, Dune, Denis Villeneuve's Dune, which they're making part two of, starring Josh Brolin, which was in a show that I talked about on Post Show Recaps. They've just cast Christopher Walken as the Padishah Emperor of Dune, which is very exciting. He obviously was like killing it on Severance. I feel like he's back in my life in a way that I want.
He was also a show I've been meaning to check out. It's a 2021 show, a Stephen Merchant run show. I guess Christopher Walken is the lead in that show as well. It's supposed to be very good. Anyway, TV.
We love TV. It's not evident. Yeah.
I mean, this show, Under the Banner of Heaven, I got very excited. It's based on a book, which I think often can be a good sign that if a good book being turned into a TV show or a movie, there's some stuff to go off of. People have read the thing and then they're like, oh, that could be good. It's also created by Dustin Lance Black, who he is an LGBT rights advocate. He wrote the movie Milk, which I'm a big fan of.
Me too.
Yeah, I like his stuff a lot. He wrote, did you watch I feel like you might, I'm thinking of a different thing. But anyway, yeah, so now he's turned Under the Banner of Heaven into a TV show. And we talked about Andrew Garfield. I feel like that's the headline. He's the lead of the show. Mm-hmm. But the cast is great here. Sam Worthington is in here. Daisy Edgar Jones. We also have Wyatt Russell, who people might know from Falcon and the Winter Soldier. There's a Culkin in this show.
There sure is, yes.
This not Macaulay or Kieran.
Part of your bringing this to my attention was like, hey, if you watch this show Under the Banner of Heaven, you should check it out. You got a bunch of cool people. You got Andrew Garfield. There's a Culkin in it. The cast is doing a lot of work. Like one episode in, I'm like supremely impressed. Gil Birmingham as well. Like I really like love what he's bringing. Very cool.
It's a real Lafferty factory up in there.
No doubt it is. Yeah,
Gil Birmingham. He from Yellowstone. Yes. He's also was in Twilight, and I think Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt as well. He's really good. I thought he was great. Detective Bill Paba. Yeah.
I love it. We'll talk.
So we have only watched one episode. The show, as we are podcasting, is still airing. So two episodes dropped on April 28th and then another May 5th. So the Thursday releases and it will go until June 2nd. We're going to do our best to sort of try to keep up with the show a little bit. We'll see if we can, how best we can line up before the end of the series. So our schedule is a TBD at the moment, but we're going to start watching. We're only watching one episode at a time and then we'll podcast about it.
To that point, you should hit us up. If you're watching Under the Banner of Heaven, and you're like fired up about it and you're like, hey, we would love to like be hearing podcasts faster. We are desperate to hear what you have to say. Then let us know. Certainly.
Yeah. I think the thing that intrigued me about the show was not just the litany of performers who are in there, but also it is a top five streaming show in the world at the moment, and also is getting very, very good reviews. If you have not heard of it and are thinking, what the heck is the show? The premise here, basically, there's this detective named Jeb Pyre, who is a member of the Church of Latter-day Saints, an LDS member, and there is a murder in his hometown of a Mormon mom and her baby that seems to involve many LDS members, including this Lafferty family, the mother married into the Lafferty family, and they are a gigantic, big Mormon family, and they're doing some cutscenes back to like the creation of the Church of Latter-day Saints, the writing of the Book of Mormon. So all of that sort of happening all at the same time. Rich, you and I love shows that travel the span of times. We love multiple timelines. So far, we basically have three. So that's in the realm of, if you're playing Dark Bingo at home, it's the Dark Timeline.
In many ways, it's evocative of True Detective, which is another sort of like criminal investigative, right? I mean, it's right there in the title, especially that season one. It's got a sort of ephemeral weirdness to the way that it's shot and it's filmed and a lot of the callbacks when we go back in time, where they're kind of like hyper-focused into specific points of view and such. But it's a very grounded show, right? We're telling a very like real kind of gruesome, some very intense story that is like focusing inward and upward into this big like hierarchical bureaucratic structure that is like the Church of Latter-day Saints, and it's very intriguing. It wouldn't have been on my radar unless you'd brought it up. We're in a weird space with TV, Grace, where like for me, I am so much back to like word of mouth, where like you know, a lot of the things that I watch nowadays are like because I hear folks in our space in the community talking about watching them and them being good. So I'm really glad you brought it onto my radar. It's great.
Thank Josh Wigler for bringing it onto my radar. So
indeed, he's a wise man. He's a wise man.
He knows a little bit about TV. I think before we dive into this episode, the one last thing I'll let people know is the book is a nonfiction book. And this is like a crime that was committed. So if you are in it for the mystery element and trying to play detective along with Detective Jeb on the show, you might want to avoid Googling a little bit.
Indeed.
Because it's a true case.
I have done very little homework or research and I'm deeply intrigued. One of like, I think the joys of like watching a show like this, it's very dark, it's very heavy, but to be able to like reflect back on it after the story is told and kind of compare and contrast to where the fiction was like exaggerated, the choices that the creators made that like deviate from the truth of the matter, and to like sort through that. It's the kind of thing that like, it's vaguely important to me when I watch a story like this and like take this information forward, but it makes it very compelling, right?
Yeah, I guess that's something we should say. Well, maybe I in retrospect, they'll have been a content warning we'll put up at the top of the episode. But yeah, I mean, it is there is a murder, including a baby, and what happens to the baby is not, you know, super great. Other than just it being murdered, and the show also talks about religion. It's obviously, you know, this is one of the reasons why I immediately thought of you, Rich, in terms of like, let's talk about the show. Is we have either we've watched and podcasted about a few shows that tackle religion. Raised by Wolves has a very heavy religious component, although a fictionalized version of religion. And then Vikings Valhalla was a show that some of the central tension of that show was about religion. So I don't know, folks who are Mormon listening, I don't know how it sort of depicts, you know, it does talk about like the formation of the Church of Latter-day Saints and these people who call themselves Mormons, you know, during the show, but we'll see how it goes. But yeah, if you're like just, you know, not into the religion, the show is very, I mean, if you didn't get it from the title, it's called Under the Banner of Heaven. But
indeed it is. That's a very it's a metaphor, but it's very on the nose kind of metaphor, right? Read it as it states. Yeah. To that point, like, yeah, I'm like so fascinated with philosophy and sociology, like the kind of human worldview and our experiences like people, right? And religion is such a fundamental and like intrinsic part of that. It's fascinating. And I think, right, like optimistically, that like with the people involved, this seems like it's probably going to take a pretty like thoughtful approach to the way that we're going to engage this. We're going to dive deep into the Church of Latter-day Saints and like the Mormon Church in a certain light and like examine this story that way. So I think that it's going to be handled carefully. The first episode, I walk away from with a lot of confidence, right, that, yeah, it's not sensationalizing, right? Yeah.
Yeah. All right, let's jump into the recap then, shall we?
Indeed.
Jeb, we meet Jeb, played by Andrew Garfield. Jeb Pyre, mowing the lawn, but his daughters want to play. She gives him the sad eyes, and so he's like, it always works. All right, so he seems like a great father. He's playing with his two daughters in the front lawn, and his wife tells him there's a phone call, and it sounds pretty urgent, so he heads inside. This is where he first meets Jeb's mom as well, who is living with them and seems to be suffering from dementia and does not always remember that her husband had passed away about 10 years ago. But the family prays together, and although Jeb asks her, you know, could you do a serious prayer and not just ask for cool stuff, she does end up asking for some cool stuff for her birthday, which is fair enough, Rich, to get a little request in prayer.
Really blame her, can you? She just squeezes a couple of things in.
Just like an easy thing for her birthday.
When he gives her the like data, she shuts it down pretty quickly.
This was the thing. Andrew Garfield is 38, which is older than I thought he was.
That's remarkable.
I know. He does sort of have like, he has baby face energy a little
bit. He's got big Paul Rudd youth face. I mean, the ageless kind of like packed. Yep.
So, you know, seeing him play like dad with like children that are like, you're like, I don't know, but I think he's pretty good here. He's not
well
bad.
I think like so much of part of like what we're presenting here, I think there's so much that's great just about this whole like opening intro, right? In terms of it being a show that's gonna like dive deep into the Mormon Church, and you're gonna take an audience like me, like you, who are coming from outside to like get this viewpoint, right? We're gonna follow Andrew Garfield, we're gonna follow Jeb in like his point of view moving through this story, right? It's not The Wire. It's like, no, you know, it's a very like point of view oriented, like kind of crime story. Right. And you know, there's a lot that's going to be different about Jeb's life and the way like they operate, but we touch on so many like kind of fundamental, like American dream touchstones. I know that you're Canadian, Grace, right? But we're on the great American continent of North America, right? We can like unite on that front. Yep. I don't know how much of like all of this is at all like evocative to your experience, right? But like the mowing the lawn, playing with dad on the front, the garage, yep, like full of stuff, mom's inside, yep, the family, dinner time, like all these very accessible things into the like, oh, and he's the sheriff, into your point that like, yeah, he's a very youthful looking man, as is his wife, who is, gosh, I don't know the actress's name off the top of my head.
Daisy Jones is is Brenda the
That's wife? What I was going to say, but no, she's not.
Adelaide
no,
Clemens plays Rebecca.
They're very like young, and part of I think what we're going to see in this show is the way that like part of their lifestyle amongst the Church of Latter-day Saints is to like start a family young. They are like young, right? Yeah, it's notable.
Rebecca has a lot, or sorry, I'm getting all their names mixed up already.
There's a lot.
I feel like it's a lot of names.
We haven't even gotten into the Lafferty's.
Yeah. I know Brenda later will make like a joke about like, yeah, I'll start my job and then I'll take a break because I'll have a family. And she, mm-hmm. she's like, you know, who says you can't have it all, right? Mm-hmm. And so yeah, I grew up in a very like, you know, I wouldn't say like a nuclear family, but like I had three siblings of three brothers, mom and dad who were together. So yeah, I feel like this is very evocative, like dad mowing the grass. That's all playing outside was a thing. I know kids play outside nowadays, but like, you know, less options to be playing inside. It was more fun to be outside sometimes. So yeah, this was all, this was great. And also immediately too, there's two things here. I think like the phone call and then, sort of the weight of him caring for his mother, as well, I imagine will be something, and we'll get into a scene later.
And we're set in like the 80s, right? Yeah. We're very like subtly like set in this backdrop of the 80s. And this is not like a prominent thing. Like the show's not trading on that, right? It is what it is. And that was refreshing, maybe in a way is the wrong word for it, but it just felt very lived in and familiar. And at a time when like the 80s is also not quite as hot as Andrew Garfield, but like there's a lot of stuff that just wants to like exist in that space, right? Right. And that's the kind of like marquee selling point. And this is not that. And I really liked it. I like the way that like it's using its place in time to like move around from where we are.
There's a thing, especially sometimes I feel pilots can feel very like setup-y. And I feel like there's one scene in particular that I feel like is a bit setup-y. Mm-hmm. Which is the introduction of the Lafferty's. And pretty much everything else is like feels pretty lived in by the time mm-hmm. we meet them, which is where it doesn't feel introductory. It just sort of feels like, okay, you're in this world now, which just happens to be like 1980s Utah. Mm-hmm. And actually really 2020s Alberta.
I mean, I think it's all kind of like very intentional. It's like we follow Jeb into the house. He goes from like mowing the lawn. You're with the kids. If you don't know exactly what you're getting into, right, and you just kind of turn this episode on, you see Andrew Garfield working on a lawnmower. He's playing with the kids. We get into the house. Now we realize like, oh, he gets this call. He's the sheriff. Wait, like evening prayer. Like there's an urgency where he's got to get mom. They're going to have the prayer early because he's got to go to work. Last minute, and like it is like the slow unfurling of like the fact that like Jeb is like an active practicing devout Mormon or a saint, I guess, as they like dub themselves, right?
He definitely won't have any like crisis of faith during
no you don't think so, right?
He'll be very firm in his belief. I'm not sure he's the sheriff. I think he's just a detective. He's the highest in command, but there's also a line later where Bill is saying like, you know, by the time our boss comes back, we're going to need to have us. And he's like, don't worry, he's out for a couple weeks. So I'm not sure he's the maybe I'm wrong. Everything I've read is that he's the detective. He's just a detective.
You're probably right.
But maybe, yes, I don't know.
He's like the ranking detective. Right. You're correct. Yes.
Anyway. Well, the show gets rather dark pretty immediately as he heads to the site of the double murder where a woman and her baby are both dead. And he's having a hard time. It seems like they all are having a tough time. There's a line later where Bill will say, like, none of these men have seen a dead body before the police department. But Jeb is not having an easy time sort of walking through the house. He does make some orders to make sure everything gets filmed. And the guy's like, I don't think I can go back in there. And Jeb's just like, yeah, but you have to. Like, we need everything on record. And then this man comes out from across the street, covered in blood, and sort of surrenders himself to the police, who we will later learn is Alan.
Indeed we will. Alan Lafferty, the first of Manny's. This is really intense, right? This is the like heavy moment that's at the front of like this inciting incident that's going to drive the rest of our story. They do a really good job with like the Jaws technique of moving through the space, creating an incredible weight through everything that is left unseen. They don't like show any kind of visceral depiction reaction of like a baby, right? The weight of all of this, Garfield is like coming apart at the seams, right? Jeb is like sobbing silently, like having to like compose himself before he steps out the door, where the other like cop, right, the kind of uniform B cop who's like found this and has been called on the scene, is sitting like broken, a man shattered on the front steps, right? And he's like, you gotta get up, like we gotta stand up for them, you gotta pull yourself together, right? This like and he like gets himself like composed and focused, but we're very aware this is like way over their heads. This is not the life that is lived in this community, right? It's this is like an earth-shattering seismic event for these people.
I'm not sure if they've, I don't even know if they've said the town that they're in, but you presume it's a small town. There's thing that happened.
Suburbia, like, right?
I grew up in a very small town. There's a thing that happened to us that like, it like the idea that this is like, it's unfathomable to think in this, in your little quaint town, that something can happen, is that this was like, yeah, very real, that like, yeah, even Jeb, who's like, you know, the detective, is like probably not dealing with murders, dealing probably with like petty crime, you know, like minor theft, garage theft and things like that, rather than this like horrific scene. And not only that, but like a baby and its mother.
I mean, he's got this moment where he stands in the hallway and he's having these kind of like flashbacks almost. He's having these like visions of like imagining the events, right? And he's just like evil, right? Yeah. It's immediately like informative as to like his viewpoint on the world, right? There is a very definable morality to this man. Like this is such as to be like unholy, right? It is so like gruesome and violent and unimaginable. And my like takeaway just from this one thing, I don't want to like linger here too long, even though the whole show is actually going to be about this. In a world where, like, I'm not one to be like, oh, violence glorified on the TV. We play a lot of Dungeons and Dragons together, Grace. We, like, I spend a lot of my time, like, fictionalizing violence and Star Wars and, like, all these kind of events. Like, we can really, like, lose the impact of, like, one life, the severity of that in this storytelling medium, I mean, right?
Yeah.
That it's not like a mass murderer or a serial killer's on the loose or, like, you know, it's about, like, the weight of like this one event. It feels incredibly powerful. It's resonant to that it would feel if it happened in your small town and in like your life, right? You feel that. It was very, very powerful.
Well, yeah. this is a show, presumably, from like the stuff that I sort of like the synopsis stuff I read, that is going to parallel this event that happens, this case of figuring out what happened here, with literally the creation of the Church of Latter-day Saints, you know?
Yeah, it's kind of wild, where, right?
Yeah, that it's going to parallel one singular, like a one murder of two human beings who die with the whole creation of the church. And obviously from this first episode, we're very much going to get into like how Alan's firm belief that like the Church of Latter, being part of the Church of Latter-day Saints, is what like corrupted these people and ultimately like caused his wife to be murdered. So it's a good point that like, yeah, we're not, this is not the serial killer story. This presumably is the like what happened in this one incident. Actually, it kind of reminds me of
radicalized religion, right? And this is the thing that I think like gets lost a lot, and like in you know, amidst like bigotry and intolerance and prejudice that's like focused around religion, right? Like so often like the radical, like the worst, most like fervent people who are willing to like take it to these like unreasonable, impossible ends and like use this doctrine to further their own like pursuit of violence, right? These are like the totems that we point to, right? In like the black and white, like, oh, this is bad and that is bad. It's like really bad. Like it's really bad.
This actually, I didn't really put this connection together, but this is a little like The Landscapers, which is a Olivia Colman show that I chatted with Sarah Carradine about on this network. It's a miniseries on HBO that is centers around one crime case and what happens in that one crime case. It's not religion based, but there's similar vibes here, I think, in terms of like one specific thing that happens and why that thing happened. So we learn that this is a Lafferty. This is the Al Lafferty, who we learn are sort of like the Kennedys of Utah. They're this big, well-known family. And so we meet Detective Bill Taba, and Jeb wants to take the lead on interviewing Alan Mormon to Mormon. So Bill says, go for it. So Jeb heads in to interview Alan. Alan says he was on a job, but he works for himself. So, you know, his story, his alibi is not going to be able to, he doesn't really have an alibi because he won't have anyone to back it up. And Taba says, you can make this real simple. Alan starts breaking down, wanting to change out of his clothes. And he says, peculiar men were taken with his family, men with beards, Book of Mormon prophets. And they want to find out where the rest of his family currently are. So a lot here, Philly.
There sure is. And like, he's just such a mess. Like the entire presentation from the moment that he comes walking up covered in blood to like, where was the job? I don't know. Yeah. Where do your brothers, they moved, you know, like all the stuff, men with beards, like the description is the worst possible description. I think so often, like when we watch TV as viewers, we have this moment of like, but just say the thing. Right. And this man is like, clearly, like not at his best, right? He's like coming apart. He's completely like overwhelmed emotionally and like frazzled, right? And I don't know what your read is in this moment, right? It seems clear the show like wants me to not trust him, and I definitely don't trust him. I'm like, oh yeah, like what, why are we doing this show? This guy definitely killed his wife, look how guilty he is. He feels like so unable to like get anything out here. It's just a really good performance, I guess, yeah, is what I'm trying to get to, because like, yeah, he got me, you know.
This is Billy Howell. He has not been in a ton of stuff. He was actually in Star Wars The Rise of Skywalker, actually playing Rey's father, apparently.
Oh great. Yeah,
I don't know. So he hasn't been in a ton of other stuff. He's a British actor, but I thought he was very good here as well. But I also was immediately in the like TV, I can't take off my TV hat. Like the first guy we meet, he can't be the murderer, right?
But like, I also was in the TV hat of like, it's all red herrings, right? The whole show is a red herring. And of course, the first guy we met is the murderer, right? Uh-huh. So like, I got in the like that like logic loop of like, I just was like, this guy, like, this is.
Could a show do that satisfyingly? Could a show?
No, but like, not all shows are satisfying. We haven't seen the end yet.
That's true. I just feel like not all shows are set. It would be an impressive feat for the show to say the first person we meet is the killer. I don't think he's the killer. I feel like this is. We're setting up the thesis of the show, right? Which is that he believes that his wife and his daughter were killed because of the corruption of these men who continued to be in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And so I just like, yeah, I guess there's a world in which it is this like, you know, I saved her from the eyes of my siblings. There is that where this very demented version of that. I just don't think it can.
I don't think it is either, but in the moment as I'm watching the scene, I'm like, oh my God, this guy is a total clown. Like, he's got nothing. Men with beards, you know, I take personal offense, first of all, but second of all, like, it's just so thin.
Big plot point in this episode. You got to find the men with beards.
Like, they have to like extract out of him. He's like biblical beards, you know, like our book. You know? And like, it's just not the kind of, you know, these people like description that you would like expect, that's very like focused and diligent. But what he's getting at again is like, yeah, ultimately like talking about like fundamentalism, right? And the idea that the inner workings within like the inner workings, it seems like what he's alluding at, or like fringe fundamentalists came in and corrupted his family is the term he uses, right? And with beards, corrupted my family. And it's just like such a line, right, that I'm like, oh my gosh. But like, ultimately he now will like start to like give us a perspective back, right? It is through like much of Alan's interrogation with Jeb here that we're gonna like get this lens back into like the Lafferty family, right?
So one quick thing I'll say very quick is that there is a world where I actually think the story can be Alan did it, but Alan didn't like he did not do it under his own volition, or he did not like there is that piece that I think like, yeah, you could come back and be like, yeah, it's him, but not in the way that like he just murders his fit. It's like very much like under direct or whatever. Like I could, that is the world where I could see, but him just like choosing to do it. The other piece is that John Oliver recently did a whole segment on like how police are so good at getting false confessions. Which is exactly like there's a lot of that in here. We're like, so right out of this meeting, Bill is like, okay, that guy's absolutely guilty, right? Like, mm-hmm. give me 10 minutes alone with him. I'm going to get a confession for like
and Bill
years,
is like the veteran, like haggard, worn detective, right? He's coming in from like somewhere else, big city vibes that like he's seen it before. He gets it. It's when it's like the wife ends up dead, it's the husband, right? Yeah.
Yeah. I'm trying to think, this might be my favorite dynamic in the show, Bill and Jeb. They are very like open with each other in terms of like, they don't hold stuff back between each other. They actually do stuff that is like Bill does something that like Jeb specifically told him not to do. And then they have this nice moment when they're eating French fries later. And they're like very clearly like, you know, they're like on the same page, just like have difference about how they're going to go about it. But like, I'm very much enjoying it. I am interested in Bill says later that like, you know, like my skin is darker than everybody else's here, which implies, you know, but like Jeb is the one who is higher in command between the two of them, and whether there's more to that as to how that's happened. But Bill, I think, is a great character so far. But just back to the confession thing, that like the like Alan stumbling like through this thing where like, yeah, it is true that like most, you know, spouse, like when a wife is murdered, it's like often the husband who has done it, or the partner that they're living with, and like, but that's something also the police, like when it's not, like the police can just immediately jump on it, and Alan is in such a state, his wife and kid have just died, right? Mm-hmm. Which can easily also be used in terms of like, and there's all this evidence to show how police basically like end up getting people to confess, and I wonder if that's coming at any point in terms of like Alan admitting, or whether that's just not where the story is going to go. But we'll see.
I think it's very fascinating look at like a lot of things here, right? Because like what you're getting ultimately from Alan, like I'm giving this very harsh read of like, oh, Alan can't get his like stuff together, he did it, right? But at the same time, if your wife and infant child, 15 month old, were just like brutalized and you just went into the house and saw all of that, like the strangers who just saw that couldn't keep themselves composed. Yeah. How is Alan supposed to keep himself composed under the duress of like angry Officer Bill Taba and Detective Jeb here that like are grilling him down, right? Because like they are like, Bill's like, yeah, you take the lead, but he does step in bad copping, right? He's like leaning on Alan through this interrogation. And quick to, because of having seen it all before and being like that tired, haggard role, right? Of like, no, I'm going to be cynical. I'm going to be jaded. Like, Occam's razor, the easiest solution here, Jeb, you know? Yeah. He also has a little bit of a sense of like, he just wants to wash his hands of it and move on. Like, the sooner we take care of this thing and button it up, the better for all of our lives, right? There is that cynicism to his worldview that is like, you know, in a lot of ways, probably systemic to police forces, but that's not what this show is. This show is actually interrogating the potential radical fundamentalism that exists within the hierarchy of like a large religious organization in the United. And so like both these things are like really alarming, but I think to your point, we are like really identifying the kind of thesis of the show, which is coming from Alan in this like, no, like they're, you know, ultimately he's saying their involvement, their investment, the deeper they got, like the more dangerous their life became ending till it ended in this gruesome way. Right. Yeah.
So we cut to Bill getting the, you know, 10 minutes alone. He's going to get the confession, asking about his brother, Ron. And Alan says, I haven't seen him for about a year. I wouldn't even know where he, you know, I don't even think the last address is where he still lives. And Bill starts talking about how he was married to a beautiful woman once, but she cheated on him, tore his heart right open. And so he sort of tries to, you know, is this what happened here? Maybe you were the one, you were cheating on her. And Alan asks, are you LDS? And he says, no. And so he says, if you want to find who's responsible, look to them. And Alan says, he isn't in the LDS anymore. And this is where Jeb comes in. And I'm not sure who's playing good cop or bad cop. Jeb starts just like reading scripture. And Bill's like, yeah, this won't be admissible at all. He's like, I don't care.
Yeah. It's all fascinating because it's kind of like a role reversal that we get here. Is we see this one. First of all, I have the question of like, and we don't need to like dive into it, but I'm curious, just like pinning a like note here of like, is Bill telling the truth, right? Is this like informative? This is like character informative about Bill in the sense that like he's saying this thing to extract, to your point. Like he's in police interrogation mode, right? So is he actually empathizing? Are we getting a viewpoint into his life, or is this purely manipulative?
Oh, I think it's so genuine. And now
I want to.
Got his heart broke at all.
Right? There is that very like relatable thing that's happening, right? But then at the same time, like we get this moment where Alan, when he realizes, you think for a moment he's gonna like push back, are you LDS? No, but like he's like, oh yeah, they did it. Like you gotta go look to them. Like if you're not one of them, that's good. I could trust you, is like the read that we're getting here. And Jeb now like flips, right? This is like the beginning of Jeb to like accept this like theorem that like maybe Alan just did it, you know? And so like Jeb is coming in blasting like scripture, like firing from the hip because he's pissed, right? He wants to like see if he could break Alan down. If Alan did this, like whoever did this is evil. We know that in Jeb's mind, right? So it's all like really intense and such like a great flip of like the fulcrum or whatever, you know? It's really, really good.
Yeah. He puts the cuffs back on him. Alan is talking about meeting his wife, and he's the one who brought her into the temple. And they're talking about like, you know, their faith. And he says her testimony was unbreakable. She was perfect. This is where we start to cut to some backstory. We see Brenda is in the car with her parents, a rather large family, as many of the Mormon families, I think all the Mormon families will meet in this episode are. And she's talking about she wants to be on TV. She wants to read the news. And also she wants to move to Salt Lake City and she'll finish school there. And Alan in a voiceover saying she came to Utah to help build up Zion. Now Alan thinks he's responsible for reeling her in. And we see that they met at church. He says, if you feel certain about something, you don't know anything. His only regret is not driving her out of Zion to help save her from these people. So,
it's really great. I mean, there's like a lot that's like happening here as we get this first kind of like look back, right? And we're now gonna like get to see Brenda's life before like this horrible tragedy that ends it so early. And there's like an innocence to her, right? We see her as this young girl, like enthusiastic, fervent about like her dedication to the church. There's also like a lot of language here that like I'm not super familiar with, right? In terms of like testimony and it being like unbreakable, these things like we hear a bunch of times. I know these words, but in terms of like the actual like dogma, doctrine, and like practice of the Church of Latter-day Saints, right? And like where that stands and like the varying kind of operations there, I'm really curious about it. I've been hesitant to like do too much research till we get a little bit deeper in because of the investigative like nature of the whole thing. Like I like it revealing itself. I want to see like how much the show can like show me on its own merit, right?
Yeah.
To that point. But yeah, Brenda's like immediately like incredibly charismatic and charming. Yep. And like you're so invested in her like right off the second she appears, right?
Her relationship with her dad, like he's like, well, if you're moving, who wants Brenda's room? And they're all like me. And so she's playful with the kid. She's just like immediately a very, very charismatic, very likable character, great. I think. Yeah. So
She's like, I'm gonna be an actress. Oh, well, you're gonna have to move to New York. I'm not moving to New York or Los Angeles. Those places are filled with like crazies and Democrats, she said. You know?
Yeah, I love the idea of like I'm moving to the big city, Salt Lake City, you know? Yep. very, very likable a character, played here by Daisy Edgar Jones, who most recently was in the Hulu movie Fresh with Sebastian Stan, but been in some other stuff. She's great. She's nice. Really good. Yep.
A couple of Falcon connections there. And meanwhile, like Alan is so become so tragic, right? I feel like this is like the intention here. I think that the show's trying to make you like be like, this guy is so shady in the interrogation, and now we get to like this second half of the interrogation of like, oh god, you know, he's overwhelmed with guilt that like his intense dedication to like religion and whatever else we're about to get from him here got this poor innocent sweet girl killed, who just like came here to like do her part in what she believes is like a better life for all of us, for all humanity, right? That's like what's so important, and like I try like not to lose sight of it's all like so tragic, right? There's a real like doomed romance happening between these two that we're gonna like watch play out, which yeah, I guess is like a guilty pleasure of mine. Should I be guilty about it? That's Romeo and Juliet, right? Yeah.
I thought it was interesting that like my reading of this initially was that like she was going to be brought into sort of the LDS or shall I just say? Yeah, LDS. Yeah. And yet that's like not what happens. She's very much like she is a part of the church. Her family is already quite religious. And so she's already like, you know, he says like she came to help build up Zion. Like that's why she came to Salt Lake City. So the fact that she's sort of already in that world, it leads me to believe that like I think that's, I'm actually like, it makes me feel more positive about the show that this is not going to be as much of a critique on like this specific religion as much as it's going to be about how one family, one, you know, this, the Lafferty family interpreted in the way that people can like abuse religion and use it as a tool for hate or for violence or whatever, rather than religion itself being inherently bad because she comes to Salt Lake City religious, wanting to, you know,
of her own accord, of her own accord, like with her own agency, she ends up here. We see that, and I think that that's like an important thing to note. And I love like what you're acknowledging, because I think it is that, right? It's not, it's clearly like not an attack on like the greater Church of Latter-day Saints or anything like that. But what
we'll see, there's also going to do the creation of the whole church, so
we will see. But it, what I think is interesting here is that when we're talking about religion, there is this overlap between what it means to be religious and practicing and the way that people like affiliate themselves with their religion and the culture that like forms around it, right? Because we clearly see that like while like Brenda might be part of the Church of Latter-day Saints, while she is with her family, she's very far removed from what amounts to like the hub, the like real like beating heart of the community that is the greater church. And the closer like she's coming into Lafferty's, the like closer she's getting like pulled into like you know, the spotlight of it all, right? As like Bill calls them out, or Jeb rather, that they're like the Kennedys of like, you know, the Mormon church or whatever. It's all really interesting. Yeah, really, he sure did. Yeah. That's not that great.
I agree. Yeah, I agree. Let's take a quick commercial break, and we'll come back with chat through the rest of the episode. All right, so this is where Jeb and Bill have a bit of a disagreement. Bill would like to notify the Brenda's family, and Jeb says, not yet. They need to track down some leads first. Jeb calls his wife because we see through sort of flashbacks that certainly the Pyres, Jeb's family, knows the Lafferty's. They've been at church events and, you know, social events and things like that. They know each other, so he says, you know, there's been an accident. Can you look to see if we have any of the Lafferty's addresses? So she does go and do that. And so they head back into the investigation, the interrogation with Alan. And they say, you know, like at the crime scene, there's no items of value taken. And if you're innocent, you just need to give us something. And this is where Alan starts to talk about how everybody had their eyes on Brenda. They all wanted to find fault in her or to save her. And sometimes both at once.
Yeah, it's really like, I don't know. I love all of this. I'm like starting to really like get into the whole vibe that like the way that Jeb's responding to Alan and like the relationship between the two of them. I do love like your call out of like the partners, like the cop buddies are good. The bromance energy between these two is like really great. They have a great like rapport. They're so wildly disparate and like different, but there is this shared respect for their different like stances and viewpoints and all of it, right? Yeah, I dig it. And like really, as we get into like this reflection of like Alan's family, that he like sets the stage this way, and then we see the scene presented as it is like very intentional, right? Like you can really see it. There's this kind of like hunger as we like shift into like this flashback that like they're like, it's like a, you know, predatory like school of sharks swarming around like blood in the water. It's really intense, and I think like Alan, the performance like does a great job kind of like launching us into it, right?
Yeah, so we cut to a flashback of Alan and Brenda, the first time that any of Alan's family has met Brenda. So it's this large family gathering, looks like some sort of like outdoor roast dinner thing that they're having. They head there on a motorcycle, and this is the first time he's ever brought a girl home. And so he meets mother and father, and some of the other grandkids are all staring at her. It's hilarious. And so we meet a bunch of characters here. So we have brothers. We have Sam, who's a brother. We have Robin, Jacob, who doesn't speak much. I'm not sure. Seems like he might have some form of disability. And then finally Ron. Everyone was attracted to Ron. And Dan also couldn't keep his eyes off her. So a lot of just like fawning over Brenda, this young cute girl.
Grace, you think of a scene in anything at all where we're introduced to more named characters at once? I just read the Wheel of Time twice.
Yeah,
notorious fair. For like 2,600 named characters over 14 books. I was like, whoa, this is it was like a machine gun of names. There's so many people that I'm trying to track.
Well, I think I wrote down the main ones, which are the brothers. I think going to be the most important. The dad's name is Eamon. I didn't catch the mom's name. I'll have to look at that.
But all the mom brothers, and dad, we can give titles to. That's fine. Mom, that's like good enough. Yeah.
But then they also do this thing because it's a bit right where Sam gets introduced and he says, these are all my kids. And they all have J names. And so then she I feel like I'm one of my skill sets. I worked at camp for a long time. I'm very good at entertaining children.
Yes,
and
you are.
Brenda is very good at entertaining children.
She's incredible.
Way that like all the names get it. And then she goes, hi, Jordan, James, John, Julia, Jeffrey, and they all laugh like it's so good. And then she's like, are you all just gonna stare at me? And they're like, yeah. She's like, okay. Like, she's very good. She's very endearing here.
Yeah. She is like really rising to the occasion as somebody that's been like brought to meet the in-laws and kind of like abandoned in like these overwhelmingly vast family functions where I'm like, grievously outnumbered and don't know anybody. And I'm just like left to float in that kind of like social ooze. It's terrifying, Grace. I am mortified. I want to like hide under picnic tables. This is like, me at my like worst possible performing level, you know. And Brenda's like so deft and incredible the way that like the family, like they just separate them immediately, right? They kind of like get them apart, like this one's over here, like she's left with the kids, the like brothers are pulling off Alan, right? She's just incredible throughout like her time here with the Lafferty's, and the Lafferty's incredible for their own reasons, but
they do a good job here, I think, of both setting up like there's a lot of characters that get introduced here, but also the power dynamics of this situation that there's a few little subtle things. So when she's talking about why she moved to Salt Lake and that in her previous school, she's like, there's only so much you can do by holding girls' hair back, that like Eamon is like sort of covering up one of his granddaughter's ears. He's like, you're pushing it a little bit. And so he's like, he's doing the like complimenting that's almost a backhand, like it's so close to being a little bit like demeaning as well, when he, you know, and she's very good at retorting back of like whatever. And then he also tells Sam is being a little, but this is the Culkin, he makes a joke at Alan's expense, and Eamon goes like, hey, don't you have a barbecue tonight? Like, don't forget that. And so he sort of like scolds him off, and you can very tell there's like this like very weird power dynamic in this this family.
Absolutely. From the second that we show up to like the whole family environment, Eamon is like commanding the space, right? The whole thing with the daughter, there is this like judgment there is immediately conveyed. This man is constantly judging you, everything, all the time. And we are looking at like a period piece set 40 some years ago in the early 80s in a 40? Pretty right. Gosh. That's terrifying to say. In a pretty conservative values environment where like, let's remember, Brenda is like the progressive in the room at this point, right? When she's talking about like going to college as like this young Mormon woman, this is radical a bit, right? And like there is all of this tension, and she's so good at being impressive and polite and endearing while like fending off all of these really like kind of latent barbs that are like getting thrown at her by the various interactions she's having. It's really incredible. The power dynamics are displayed like excellently, and the character just notes as we're being introduced to so many brothers that have this kind of universal color palette of like, they're blonde, you know, they're all like varying shades of blonde. They're like, you know,
Talk about everybody was attracted to Ron because he's saying she was attracted to Ron. How do you know that? Because everybody was. This is the Sam Worthington character. We also meet Dan, who this guy's really good at playing creep. I think he was very good at that in Falcon the Winter Soldier. This is Wyatt Russell, I believe the son of Kurt Russell, if I'm not mistaken.
I think you are correct. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, he picks the ladybug out of her hair and is very, you know, talking about if you could, you know, squeeze down some of this grass into juice. It's like drinking Heavenly Father's love. And his wife is Matilda, who I think might be the person I'm like the most intrigued by of any.
She's
of the,
fascinating. Is that like a Scottish or an Irish accent that she has? There she is, like. Right,
definitely from the United Kingdom. But she's Scottish. She's a Scottish actress. So.
Okay, I thought it was Scottish. Right.
Oh well, they say this. They right. He said he went to. He did it. Dan did his mission.
Right. I missed that they said Scotland. I guess, but there is a note here where like they have children, but they're hers not his. And now like they're both, and he's got, and it's so immediately their dynamic of like this kind of submissive wife, and like the like
dominant my children. Our children.
Yeah.
Our children.
She is like so like timid and frazzled and like at the same time, like over enthusiastic and energized. There's this like manic energy just like vibrating off Matilda when she's around Brenda, like specifically, that is like electric, you know. It's she's great. Yeah.
Yeah. So we do see a man knock on the door, sort of this older frail man, and we do hear him say, "They've come for me." This is Diana. Is it Diana? I think it's Diana. I think it's Diana. And Diana goes and gets Ron to go and talk to him.
Yeah.
And Dan wants Brenda to sit with them, but then Diana says, "No, we saved you a seat over here," and pulls Brenda and Alan to come sit next to them. This is where we learn Ron is in construction. Alan calls it the best construction company in Utah. And he also sits on the city council. We learned that Matilda met Dan when he was on mission. And Brenda says, "I didn't know you could do that." And Diana sort of makes a joke. And I think what they're implying here, and you correct me if I misread this, that Diana met Ron while he was on mission. And also, so they both sort of have done this thing that you're not supposed to do in terms of meeting their husbands.
Yes, yeah. That also was my read, right? That like this is a little bit taboo. It's frowned on.
Joking, you know.
Right? Yeah. And they're like kind of the like, "Oh no, like, you know, we may not have like gotten to like, you know, the big college and like held girls' hairs over the toilet, but like we had our crazy days too." You know what I mean? There's that like kind of relatable sister-in-law vibe happening. Diana being like really great, like the best at like being like,
yeah,
with Brenda specifically, like, "Yeah, this is all a lot, but like, I see you, girl." You know, they have this kind of like, they're both even still a lot, but they seem to have like Diana's like aware of how intense this is and seems to be the only one here that's trying to manage the situation of Brenda's favor at all.
It's like, I married the oldest, you married the youngest, we can trade notes later. Like, she's being pretty like buddy with, where there's a lot of other stuff that feels, she says don't worry, like no matter what else happens, like you're the star tonight.
Very just, notably, she like gets her away from Dan, who I can't overstate how overwhelmingly creepy he is. Yes, to your point, like it's so creepy when he's like trying to get her, "Oh, you can come sit with me, we split the couples up." And Alan is like, you hear like the panic and the twinge of his voice of like, no, like she could sit anywhere. She could go sit next to Dad, like Eamon over there would be better than like to sit next to Dan, is the impression, right? Like, I don't know.
Yeah. I got two reads from this little scene that I think will be important moving forward. So one is the reveal that both Matilda and Diana met their partners while they were on mission. It tells me a lot about the Lafferty family and power and how they are in control of power dynamics, that they end up marrying women in situations where you are not supposed to get together with the person who's on mission. So that tells me a lot about who this family is, that they don't necessarily have to play by the same rules as anybody, as other folks.
Right.
And then the line that Diana says, "Don't worry, you're the star tonight." But I presume that in the eyes of these men, she is the star going forward. It is not just tonight. Her entrance into this family, unfortunately, is not a great thing. You know, when he's talking about they always had their eyes on her. It's such an unfortunate.
This is like a catalyst moment, right? Where like it's going to change these, like, you know, to your point, these like carefully established power dynamics, right? The entrance of this kind of like progressive, attractive, compelling, charismatic woman into this family is about to like disrupt what has gone on up until now. Right.
Yeah. So then we see Eamon is yelling at Ron sort of from a distance, and Brenda is watching this. The old man is standing behind Eamon yelling at Ron. And then Eamon makes a speech before dinner and says that they have been called to service. Their neighbor needs his farm to be removed. The stones need to be removed from his farmland, or else they're going to build a highway over his land. And he says, together we can do anything, which seems to be a line that they sort of repeat. He invites them to repeat it with him. So probably a family catchphrase. And as they go to pray, Eamon does notice Brenda sort of taking a peek,
and her eyes are open, and clearly he is opening his eyes like to assess, right, and make sure everybody is following the rules as like this patriarch of this gigantic like family. It's a lot, right? She also, like, during the like kind of removal of the stone, or I'm jumping ahead, right, there's like end up going to move the stones for the neighbor, and like she then like pushes it even further, and she's like runs out into the field with the boys as like we see the whole family kind of go down, and she like runs out and dares to like pick the stones up and throw them into the truck with the boys, which we could see again, like it's like taboo. It's just a little too much. The women are all like overwhelmed. Matilda doesn't even know what to do. She like starts chasing Matilda
wants to go. I feel like Matilda wants to go out, and
she does.
Like, that looks so much fun, and I know I can't do it. You know?
Yeah.
Kind of sad.
It is. It's very sad. It's like tragic, but like just like, again, like, you know, these tiny little things that are like, you know, grating against the system, right?
Yeah. So we've seen Eamon not be happy with Ron. We see him yelling at him. And then we see Eamon watching as Brenda makes sort of two faux pas here, opening her eyes. Even the introduction, I think Brenda plays it up pretty well, but I think Eamon is skeptical. And then his like sort of like, I feel like he gets confirmed in that he had suspicions about her a little bit as a person in terms of the eyes during praying and then her running out to like pick up the rocks. Mm-hmm. So we'll see that play out, but there's this very interesting scene back where they're Alan's being interrogated, and he's saying that we like to think of ourselves as one big family. But we're also taught that there can only be one leader. Mm-hmm. He also says that LDS women are taught to obey. And he asked Jeb, do you think that she deserved being murdered? If she wasn't obeying? And he says, no. And so he says, well, then you might not be as good of an LDS as you think. So that's what a brutal,
it's incredibly brutal, right? I mean, it's Alan like insinuating that like, I mean, to me, again, not being like deeply familiar with the doctrine of like the LDS church, like look, religious institutions are like really, they're living in a lot of ways. They evolve. They like change with the times, right? Like things get changed. Ideas that once could be like, you know, proselytized about like fall and can no longer, they conflict. Like clearly the kind of like the suggestion, the whole thing of like the highway coming and we got to move the stones, right? Mm-hmm. Like the state's going to like pave the land unless like he's able to get it active and fertile and farming and show that like whatever, they can't like take it away from him. It's vital to its business. That's me doing like the extra read as a person that like has existed in like agricultural space professionally. Right. But I don't know. It's interesting. This suggestion that Alan is making here that like, oh, well, by some people's standards, like, yeah, like you're not as good as an LDS as you think if you don't think that's true. Right.
Yeah. And I think this is like, again, I think the interpretation of this is like this is what Alan views as like LDS, when like I do think this is like the most probably like some of the most like radicalized, like extreme versions of LDS. Like there's lots of, you know, I think one of the things that like about modern religion that can be unfortunate is that like is there stuff like in the Bible that says like, you know, alludes to like, you know, there can't like, you know, being a homosexual is a sin. Sure. Sure. There's like a ton of other stuff in the Bible that also like is a sin that people do all the time. Like, to live by everything that's in the Bible is an impossible feat for anybody to do. And if they do, they're like quite an extreme version of modern like Christianity. And so, yeah, it's like there's a lot of stuff in the Bible that like contradicts even that stuff of like, you know, it's like, yeah, be kind to your neighbor, you know. And so I think that this scene here where Alan's like, I don't think you're as good as an LDS as you think. I think you also have to take that with the lens of like, this is what Alan knows LDS to be, right? His extreme family version of LDS, right?
Promise is like Alan's going to tell us a story of a man who was raised in this family that we just saw that is like 40 deep, as hardcore LDS as you get, right? Where their entire family unit is like functions almost like a business with hierarchical. It is regimented. You go out, you find a wife, you bring them back here to raise your family and have more kids to send them, right? And to this cynic, to a man who's like faith has fallen, who is pointing like, no, this institution is like the reason that this woman and my baby have been like brutally killed, right? And so I want to like see what that story is. But like, again, like you know, when we're talking about any of these things, like Christianity is so like vast and sprawling, and there's so many like sects and variations and all of it, right? But when we start taking like texts that are thousands of years old, the Church of like Latter-day Saints, much like younger and newer, right, and like centuries old, and interpret them like literally when we exist in like a modern world, like things fail, systems fail, they do not hold up, they don't pass the test, right? They need to like evolve, they need to grow, and like part of understanding any kind of religious text is being able to like parse metaphor, I think, right? Because the whole like function of religion is to reconcile the irreconcilable questions to our existence. You know, it is faith because it's blind and we don't know, it can't be proven, it's not provable. I just finished Outer Range with Austin, no spoilers, right? But there's a tremendous line where like there's an exchange between a couple of characters like, oh, I don't know what God is. Like, yeah, well, you don't need to, that's the point. And this person being like, yeah, I do, you know, and like that's part of life in the modern world, I think, when we have so much science at our hands. I know I'm ranting now, but
no, what is a podcast for if not for
if rants? Not a rant?
Yeah, it's just one long rant.
Rant recorded.
So we get the rock cleanup. The old man is like very grateful, seemingly sort of like bewilderingly staring at these
what
stones.
A tremendous old man too, huh, Gracie? It's like he walked right out of that painting, you know.
He looks exactly like the guy. I feel like I've seen this guy and he just plays like this thing.
He's just the old farmer. Frail
old man.
Yeah,
I think.
Exactly.
Yeah, I like almost want to figure out who he is. Yeah. And then Eamon, of course, has to make a speech, but he actually announces that they're leaving for a bit and they need to decide who is going to run the family while he's gone. And did I catch this right? Sam Worthington seems older than Wyatt Russell, but he does call Wyatt Russell he calls Dan the oldest.
Son, and that moves me, right? And that's part of my read. It's like there's a suggestion almost that like he's cut the other one off or something. I'm like, I don't know, it doesn't make any sense. There's some confusing things about this to me here.
I'm intrigued. I gotta say, Sam Worthington looks older than Wyatt Russell, but nevertheless. But Ron is somebody who has established, he's a city council member, he's established the largest construction company in Utah, so he is very successful, whereas we do not know that much about Dan, but seemingly not as successful as Ron. And
well, doesn't he call out like he just finished his chiropractor degree?
That's right.
He just got his chiropractor degree. I thought this was gonna be the call out to preclude him of like he's gotta go be a chiropractor now, so he can't manage the family business, but in fact it seems to legitimize the claim that like now that he's a licensed chiropractor he can take over.
That's right. I forgot. Yes. Someone must stand on their shoes while they're away. And Dan has never been as singularly focused, but he did graduate. So they'll all put their faith in Dan. Robin will be his right-hand man. Jacob and Sam will make sure that the home is in better condition when they left. Alan has his hands quite full. don't like that. So keep working on that, he says, alluding to Brenda. And he stares at Ron and doesn't say anything. He turns away. And then Dan prays.
This was my illusion, right? It's like, as he's beginning the speech, the framing of the shot is very much led. So he's looking at Ron. Like Sam Worthington is like a commanding presence amidst these brothers, right? The casting is like really good. No, like shade to anyone, but like you could see the way like his presence is like looming and powerful amidst these guys, right? He seems like, I think, older because he seems more capable and like measured and confident the way like he's holding himself compared to like why Russell stand there, right? And then yeah, like the whole like you've got your hands full, Alan, you know. Like, the subtle needling, like
Alan is the youngest, so like
I have a parent, you know, who like yeah. every other thing that they say is this kind of like innocuous insult, you know what I mean? It's all like these cutting barbs. I was like, wait, what does that mean? What? Yeah. And like it's like, oh my god, dude, I could like so relate to like poor Alan, however he ended up, right?
Good work, you know, good work, sibling number one. You do, yeah, good, sibling number two. Sibling number three, you're living your life. All right, moving on.
And then, like, side number four, like, I'm just going to admit you. Like, the whole omission of Ron to me reads as, like, he's cut this kid out for some reason, right?
Like, there's a disagreement. I wonder if it's a power. I wonder if it was if it's, like, sort of a power shift.
Oh, yeah, that's very much what it feels like. I think that's so much a story of like fathers and sons coming of age and fathers relinquishing power. And like, yeah, absolutely, right?
Because you would think that he, you know, if Ron's a city councilor and they want to build Zion in the city of, you know, you'd think that could be useful. Although I guess it's not implied that if he's a Salt Lake City councilor, whether this is the sort of a smaller town outside of. This
is a very beautiful compound that they have here for their family. It's very like idyllic. Actually, and like
it is very nice. Yeah. So I just found Old Man.
Nice.
It's Robert Cornes. I would just like to play a small game. I'll tell you a movie this was, and if you could just tell me what role you think this person played. So in 2022, he was in Fresh. Could you guess the name of his role in the movie Fresh Philly?
Yeah.
What's his? You want to guess?
Old Man.
Yeah, Older Man. This is
did I miss the conjugation there?
That's okay. I'll give it to you. In 2019, he's in a movie called C. Do you want to guess what his title is in that movie?
What's the name of the movie again?
It's called C.
From 2019.
Yeah. Oh, it's a TV series.
Yeah, he played Old Man.
He did play Old Man in 2019.
Yes, I'm winning the game.
In 2018, he was in a TV show called Travelers. Would you like to guess what his role, what he was credited as in that movie, in that TV show?
2018, you say?
Yeah.
I'm willing to double down here. I think it's going to be Old Man.
It is Old Man.
Old Man. Old Man.
In 2017, this he had a role.
How
in
far
the good,
back do they
hold
go?
On, I got you. I got you. He's in The Good Doctor TV show. Right. Would you like to guess his title of his credited role in The Good Doctor in 2017?
Maybe this was like the original appearance of Older Man.
No, he was Old Man.
He was Old Man. Okay.
In 1990. He's in a movie called Angel Square. Would you like to take a guess at what his credited role was in the 1990 movie Angel Square?
1990.
Yeah, before I was born.
32 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Was he middle-aged man?
No, he was Bony Man.
Bony Man.
And you know what? I can see it.
This poor guy. He's
to credit to him, he has many other he has named character. He's Beggar, he's Homeless Man, he was a guy named Roger in a movie. So he has other roles, but he's often credited as Old Man.
I portrayed Homeless Man at an RHAP event once, live in New York.
That's Robert Cornes.
That's so remarkable. Bony Man, 1990, got 32 years.
I don't want to watch the movie. Maybe it's a future movie club.
Unbelievable. The Robert Cornes movie podcast. We could just like trace back the legacy.
Okay. Yeah, forget Coleman cast. We're going to go Cornes cast.
The Cornes cast. Yeah. Okay.
So Ron walks off after he doesn't get acknowledged in the speech, and his mom comes in, and he cries on her shoulder, and she says, "You're the fulfillment of the Heavenly Father's promise that he would send one mighty and strong to set things in order. He sent me six, but you're my one. Don't let your father sway you from that righteous calling. So a kind mother, although picking favorites.
Yeah, she very much picks favorites. This woman, clearly there's a lot of dysfunction that we see from the matriarch who's inside of like the hierarchy of the system. We see that like probably the impression I take away here is she's been nursing this flame in young Ron for a long time, which has like made it even more contentious. Also, it's very vulnerable and sweet, but it's a little bit creepy to me. There is kind of like intimacy being shared between these two. I mean, you're calling it out, but yeah, it is very like Paul and and his mom. Oh, yeah. I mean, there's a lot of like, I don't know, there's a lot happening here, but I don't know. Ron's compelling. I find Ron a very interesting character.
I mean, Sam Worthington, so they got a big name to play this character in particular. Yep. I'm intrigued by where this story goes for sure.
He's so vulnerable in this moment, right? As he's like leaning there, like kind of crying on his mother's shoulder. And like, I dig it. He's doing a lot with the performance.
Mm-hmm. So they end up finding out that, they find out that Jeb's wife has delivered the number for Robin's address, Robin Lafferty. And he remembers seeing them at church events. Alan says he stopped seeing his family when he stopped going to church. And he gets asked if he misses the church. He misses what they learned as boys, the larger LDS family, the idea that they had each other's backs. He missed the days when he believed their God was loved. And this is where we start to get flashbacks of a young Joseph Smith, the founder of the Church of Latter-day Saints. At 15 years old, he created a new church. He was urged by love. He learned that there was a book buried in the ground, and the Holy Spirit told him to marry Emma. That's the church that Alan misses.
How did you feel about the flashbacks, about the diving back to Joseph Smith?
On one hand, I feel like it's a bit, so all the stuff that I thought was sort of working with this like critique of how religion can be wielded in the right hand.
Yes.
Is really strong. And then I worry about going to the beginning of Mormonism and
attacking and how its roots.
Yeah. And so I don't, you know, what's interesting is we have Alan here, who is the most dismissive of the Church of Latter-day Saints, also saying here, he's the one telling the story basically about Joseph. He brings up an analogy later about the history of this church that, you know, all about the father-in-law, and saying if Joseph never married, you know, if Joseph like listened to Mary's father, they would have never got married. The church never would have been created. So I hope that because here's my thing on religion. I'm not a religious person, but mm-hmm. my family, I have a few family members, including my parents, who are very religious, mm-hmm. and I love what they get out of religion.
Yes.
I love that my parents in particular, like the church that we had for a very long time in our small hometown was like 175 years old. So just like crumbling, and the church couldn't afford to keep it. They decided to sell it, and they didn't really have like a place. And so my parents helped like buy this like restaurant that went out of business and turn it into a church, but also like use it during the weeks as like an after school program for like daycare and like and yep. then homework programs and things like yep. that. And like what my parents helped build was this like very thriving community.
Yep.
And so I love that. And my brother has used religion a lot to help him overcome some of the stuff that he's really struggled with. And so I love that people can get that out of religion, mm-hmm. as long as you're not wielding it to be hateful. Yep. And so I hope that this story it's very interesting. I think that my like nicest version of what I hope it is like a little bit like optimistic about what it could have been rather than what the way it gets wielded in some way.
So this is fascinating. But so you're touching on a lot of points that are very close to home to me. But I think that the suggestion of the distinction between what a religion can be, what it brings to some people's lives, the kind of value that it creates, the kind of community that it creates. Because I have had a similar experience. I've talked about it in like different places at different points, but like, my experience with religion as a young child was being raised by a bunch of people that kind of paid lip service to it. You had to show up at church on Easter and on Christmas and like for the important things, somebody's kids getting a communion and like, oh, you're 12 now, it's time for you to go do the thing and get like confirmation. It was all very kind of hollow and ritualistic, and I challenged that and was told like no, you have to do it for appearances, which was jarring to me as a very young person, and I ended up in a religious school for a period of time. I went to a Southern Baptist boarding school that is pretty recognized here, like nationally, for a bunch of the programs that it has. I won't like call it out here, but the many of the individuals who were faculty and the leadership there that were like in charge of like that were responsible for the well-being of 500 and 600 children wielded religion very dangerously and for like a lot of ill and for ill intent. And it was a really inhospitable environment. And I left that place like jaded and cynical, only to meet a lot of people in my later life that much like your family, that like religion is so like powerful and important and a feature that like draws community together to like do great things and like better the rest of the community around them and like creates shelter for people who need it. There's so much there of value, and the distinction between the ways that we as individuals choose to take our religion, engage with it, share it, like, you know, embody it is really interesting to me. So I hope there is a hopeful part of what the show Under the Banner of Heaven is doing in terms of the way that it's examining the Church of Latter-day Saints. And we're able to like recognize, I think very obviously we could look to Jeb as a man that like is a good man. This is a good man, right? We haven't seen anything yet, but like, you know, to the point that this isn't The Wire, I don't think the guy's McNulty. I don't think we're going to get the Jeb like is actually a monster reveal.
Or well, was wondering earlier, I don't think we're getting that either. And I was wondering whether there is a character on the board who will see, when you talked about not trusting Alan, will they do the subversion of that with somebody else? And the only person I could put on the board is Brenda, but I really would hate it depends on what the true story is. Murdered character to then be the like, you know, not you know, whatever. But I can't think of anybody else we've seen who I could see like being
there was
much
a moment
evil, maybe Diana
one I'll say where like I was reading like wait like because Jeb clearly knew the Lafferty's, he'd seen them in church, he'd seen these people, he knew Brenda. It's giving us some more context for maybe why he was reacting so powerfully. It's that extra degree closer to home, not just like the neighbor in the town you live in, but like the neighbor in the church you go to, you've sat like pews from every week for years, right? But I was wondering like, oh, did he have some affection for her? Was there a crush? Was there a thing there? But I don't think so. I don't think that's what that's about.
Polygamy. Polygamy in the Church of Latter, is that, I'll have to do some research. I'm wondering.
I think that this is a misnomer and like an appellation that gets often applied to Mormons and Mormonism.
It's not, it's been outlawed for a long time, right?
And practicing, but I think it's like, exists in probably some radical groups that practice, right? So I don't know. I think that again, this is like the totem pole of like the worst possible example that stands out above for many of us that are like outside looking into a culture we don't know about, right? I think
my only knowledge of Sister Wives polygamy comes from the TLC show Sister Wives. That's all I know, which is set in Utah, I believe.
Yep.
But I don't think they are
LDS. Pretty wild.
Anyway, that was something I was like, what, this show is still going on, Sister Wives? Wow, 16 seasons.
I'm not going to podcast about that one, Grace. I can't do it.
Mr. Wives is over. I guess not. But we're just
oh my gosh. Where have we gone? Where are we?
Oh my gosh. Cornus is in Sister. He plays old man. No, I'm just kidding. So we head to Robin's house. There's a fire. He seemingly burned a bunch of papers. I was surprised they didn't try to start to put out the fire to collect any remaining evidence from. They just seemed to like, well,
no,
those are burns.
Yeah, we went full TV drama, right? The whole thing of like, there's the little hibachi back in barbecue in the backyard with like the documentation flaming. Like he just ran out the door, you know? It's like,
stomp it out. There's probably words you could get from that.
You could definitely read like at least 60% of it. Yeah.
Yeah. And I would get the voiceover again, this faith breeds dangerous men. You see there's a gun cabinet with some ammunition in it. And Jeb is feeling that this might feel more than just a domestic. Taba says, Jeb, you got to trust me on this one. And Bill then calls Brenda's dad. And then we see a confrontation between Jeb and Bill, where he says, did you call the father? And Jeb says, I wanted to have answers at the ready, so we didn't have to call him twice. He says, you're not in charge here. And this is where Bill says, yeah, I know my skin is darker than his, and he knows he's not as welcome, but he's seen a lot more than a lot of these people around here have. And Bill says he talked to an actual source, which we then learn is Brenda's dad. As he had called him to let him know. And he revealed that Brenda said she was afraid of Alan and she wanted to leave a while ago because that he beat her. He says he didn't beat on her. They got in one fight. Not the first man in history to not be well liked by his father-in-law. And then again, we get more of this flashbacky or sort of like alluding to the history of the of Mormonism, where, you know, Emma's father thought that Joseph was a con man. Is it Emma or Mary? Mary. If Joseph had put her father's words above hers, then there wouldn't be the one true church. And so, yeah, they confront Alan again about really trying to put like the screws to him. Like, you know, your wife was this is where we get the details, which are horrific. Yeah, so I'm not going to go into it, but it's pretty horrific.
Yes. Asked if he's almost like worse than like what we've seen. Right. Yep. But I think it's a very smart storytelling device is all I'll say, that they separate these things and like hit you with it again while like Alan is like reeling at the end of the episode. Remind just the weight of what's going on here. Yeah.
Yeah. They ask if he harmed his brothers too. He says, no, men with beards corrupted his family. His faith is the faith is persuading men of faith to spill more blood. Go and pray to your God and ask him for wisdom. So, yeah,
all of this is great. There's a lot of great stuff happening here, right? The whole like relationship between Bill and Jeb is excellent. Like Bill being like, look, man, this is what you got to do. You know, like this girl's like father needs to know. And he goes and he makes the call, and Jeb like being angry about that. You can like read it in a couple of different ways. Like he's just overwhelmed. He's trying to like do everything at once. But it's also this real small town perspective of like, no, just want to get all the answers. And Bill's kind of like sitting here like, buddy, you wait for all the answers. You're never going to tell this guy anything, right? No. But meanwhile, we get the shift finally by the end that Jeb's like, yeah, put the APB out on the bearded men, you know, this acknowledgement that he's like buying in Alan's story and the whole like, yeah, he does have to pray. Alan tells him like, go pray to your God, like, because he knows, right? There's this insight between them that Alan is like saying to this guy, listen, if you're like a good Mormon and a good man, which are not like mutually exclusive, then go and pray to your God and let him give you the wisdom what you're supposed to do here, man. Cause like, this is not good. And Jeb like shifts and is beginning to like get some doubt here. And this whole like, oh, you beat the wife. No, just that one time. Like, this is all the kind of stuff that you layer into, I think, a lot of like the criminal investigatory shows, right? Like, it's bad. It's indicting. Like, it's enough probably for your wife to be really like, dude, F you, I'm out, right? Like, how many times? It should never need to be more than one time. But you can also like sense the desperation in Alan at this point. So like, it's more of like, do we go back to that first scene? Did Alan do it? Is this guy like, you know, blowing smoke with like the bearded men? It's all very well done though. Yep.
He doesn't necessarily, he says they got in a fight. He got in one fight. These are really tough because we're doing Shining Girls as well, right? Where there is this like story, there is this piece that where like the one guy gets, he has like a domestic write-up, right. And he is supposed to be someone that we are rooting for in some sense. And I do get the sense here this episode that we actually are supposed to root for Alan in some sense. And then they're like, he might have beaten his wife, which he doesn't say. He never admits that he explicitly says, I hit my wife. He says we got in one fight. So that could be any number of things, including that they are physical with each other, but it's not inherently. I'm really trying to tread lightly with this, and that I don't want to feel like I'm dismissing.
You can't be dismissive of it, right? Because if he beat his wife one time, that's enough that like go put the guy in jail and like get the wife out, and like she should be allowed to leave and nobody should end up dead, right? But at the same time, if they got like an argument and one time he did a thing that like then like his wife told her father, like, oh yes, he slammed a door, he pushed me, he's something, right? That the father's like, he beats my daughter, right? There,
she makes a move, like a he reason, gets right? her wrist.
And
he,
like, we don't have, like,
yeah,
any information here. So I didn't think that there's like any reason to like defend Alan or like read it charitably. He's like, you know, a suspect for a murder investigation for like a horrific killing, except that like, again, we're moving through like the TV cycle and he is like, look, yeah, I'm sorry. But like also what Alan has told us corroborates that his father-in-law would hate him. Right. Yeah. If he drew his poor innocent daughter who like just wanted to go off to go to college to be a newscaster into this like fervent family of Mormons that have ended up in this like spiral where now she's dead, like there should be a lot of animosity regardless of what like violence may have occurred in the home beforehand. But yeah, domestic abuse is not excusable and there's no reason to like, give him the benefit of the doubt. Right. Like it's, we're watching TV. I don't think we need to like flagellate ourselves more than that. Right. I think
they put out the APB. They talk about that the autopsies are scheduled for 9 a.m. And Bill says, you want me to keep pushing the kid? Jeb starts telling the stories. Like, out in Florida, Henry Lee Lucas said he killed 60 people once he started telling the truth. He just kind of says it.
Grasping at straws for like, is there a chance we crack this guy open and he's like a crazy killer? Like, is there a chance there's like a serial killer out here? I think that this is his desperate, like, please tell me that Alan's story doesn't have credibility. Right. Please, like, tell me there's a psychotic, like, maniac out here serial killing that happened to stumble into like confused, damaged Alan's house and kill his like poor Brenda and his kid, and like, you know, that it's not actually pointing back to the church, right? This seems like a desperate last gasp plea of like, it's anything but, right?
Right, because he talks here about how there was bishop where like five boys and a girl went missing. There were black roses on the grave after the body showed up. He talked about it being devil worship. And so he's sort of alluding, like, is this like Alan moving out from the church and like becoming like this? Which I think does make sense here. I think, as we've talked about, that like Jeb is going to go through this like crisis of faith in this show, and it would make sense that he would sort of think like, well, what if there's just, you know, if he left the church, then maybe he's a bad guy, you know. And he says, what if he cracked and killed his own family, came for his daughter and his wife last? You know, they says, if Bill says they don't charge him within 36 hours, he's just going to be able to leave. And then this is where they say the chief won't be back for another week, so, you know, they can do whatever.
I totally missed that. Yeah, that's great. Excellent.
Nice. I think sketch. It's the chief. I think. I believe so. Mm-hmm. And they say, you know, Bill's like, if this guy's as well known as you say he is, like, they're going to need like a suspect and information and a name. This is where they have the little joke about, he's like, you know, you could just ask me, you know, do you want some, can I have some fries? And he's like, no. And then he's like, yeah, those things are going to kill you. He says, well, let's die happy. And he offers us a French fries. He says, Bill, you're a bad influence. This is great. I love this.
It's a fantastic scene as Jeb like hunches down and hides behind the desk so the other guys don't see him like succumbing and eating the fries. There's such like friendly camaraderie between the two of them. Bill or Eddie is like completely like stepped outside of the bounds of what Jeb told him to do, but they're able to like sit here and share these fries. We get the impression this is like a high stakes moment, like high stress, but also that like probably this has happened before, you know, the like with your Bill. Bad influence on
me. Oh, yes.
Yeah.
I love your, like, I mean, they're talking about some dark stuff. They're like, you know, this guy, you know, really, Henry Lee Lucas, he killed 60 people once he started to confess. Like, you know, these like kids, what they're thinking, could Alan be like a serial killer of like children? Did he kill his old family? They're just like talking about this. And then, I don't know, I am definitely somebody who gets through like dark stuff with like humor, and this is like that being very jokey, and like that's sometimes what I need in like these like tense moments, is like someone to just break that tension. And so I just think that this was really great and really good script writing, because there's a tendency, I think, for shows to want to be like super serious shows like this that's super dark, to be dark the whole time. We're just going to be in this, we're going to be dark and gritty the whole time.
Why don't you just ask me? You can have one.
Yeah, it's French. It's all about French fries. It's great.
Those things are going to kill you, Bill. You know what I mean? It could have been like, yeah. No, it's great. And it does like alleviate a lot of the tension. And it plays to this trope of like the cops like dealing with this stuff, Do you know what I mean? It's got that, like, we see it day in and day out. A little bit of like Bill kind of like pushing that vibe almost, as like Jeb is like talking about the serial killer of like, all right, let's take it down a notch, right?
Yeah.
Let's like stop worried about the serial killers killing 60 people and Satanists. Like, we got one horrific thing that we can focus our energy on, and French fries.
So they get a call, and they, a man at a motel says, there's a guy here and he fits the APB. So they head out there. They see this family hold up in a room. I did not recognize the wife. I think very cleverly, we do not get introduced to this woman. Although I wonder if I went back and looked again, whether she's in the background of the scene, because it's Robin's wife.
It's Robin's wife, right? Which there is a point where he's like, this is my wife and my brood, right?
Yeah, right.
When we see her at the family, but I don't know that we get her name. Okay.
And so they realize that Robin has run out the back door. They chase after him. And when they find him, he's sort of kneeling down and he's praying. And it's Robin Lafferty. And this is where Bill sort of pulls Jeb aside and says, like, you went to church with these boys. They know your face. You should go home. I'll take care of this. You make sure your family is safe, which is very good from Bill to do. But also, like, that's pretty effed to be like that they'll start coming after them. That's very good thinking from Bill in a way that's like very sad that he's been too close to some of these situations before, I think.
Yeah, I mean, Bill gets it, man. Like, I think that like one of the parts of the commentary we're talking about here is that like this community is insulated, and for better or for worse, there is like a sense of security and positivity. And like, I think that there's a point where Jeb's like, oh, we don't lock our doors or something like that. Like, you know, this is so intense for them. And Bill is cynical and gets it, man. And as soon as this thing is starting to prove out, as soon as anything Alan has said is garnering any kind of credibility for Bill, he's like, okay, if this is like bigger to that extent, then you need to like get out of here, man. Like, you have people that could be in danger, right? And this is all like kind of madness. This guy's like setting stuff on fire, you know, he's out here running. And like, Robin's like crazy, right? Like, he's not like crazy, literally mentally ill, but like, he's sitting there praying to them, yelling to them, you know, like, it is, this is the kind of like very high tension confrontation that we get at the end here.
He says his name. We never locked our doors as a kid until our house got robbed, and then
yeah, that'll get you.
Nothing like huge, just like some laptops and some electronics, but yeah, it's annoying. And then I always would forget my key, so that was very annoying. Jeb goes home and he sort of gets spooked. His mom comes up from behind him, and he says, like, you know, he starts talking about, you know, you told me like in heaven we'd all be together for all of eternity. And she says, he's gone, isn't he? And Jeb says, yeah, he died 10 years ago. And she says, I want to be with him. I want to go now where things are right. So this is intense.
Yeah, it's tragic. I mean, you talked about like Vikings Valhalla as a thing we watched, and like, you know, part of the Norse religion, this idea that like Valhalla and these Vikings that like want to die in battle to get there, right? Certainly like the competing faction from that show, Christianity, which like gives birth to the Church of Latter-day Saints here. This notion of heaven is like an idyllic place. And this is like a really tragic suggestion, you know, and kind of frightening, the notion that, and again, it ties fascinatingly back to the show that Austin and I were covering just recently that just finished up on Amazon Prime, Outer Range, which I'm going to keep bringing up because this is where I think there's some shared DNA. It's got some big exploration of faith themes, crisis of faith, what it means to individuals, and like where it wears out its welcome or runs its course. And it's fascinating here, right? The suggestion that like, she's like, oh, but like this paradise, this like heaven that is promised by our religion, I just want to go there. Things are right. Like, life is hell. You know, that's very sad and tragic.
So I did a quick search when I said, because I was wondering about whether, is this going to be a thing? Because a lot of talk in you know, around the world about like euthanasia and physician assisted suicide.
Oh, yes.
And that's what this felt like to me. Was that the read?
I think we're approaching spaces where we could be engaging with that, certainly, right? As we're like doing this exploration of the Mormon church and like through the lens of this murder investigation, I think there also needs to be the examination of Jeb's home life, right? And this is a way to like get into like ideas and the church's stance on stuff, because like almost universally it's got to be no, right? No chance.
It is no. But I also wonder, she has dementia, and so I also wonder, he says 10 years ago. I wonder how many times they've had this conversation. And so is this just the thing that weighs on him a lot? Because like when we meet her, she's actually pretty like together. Happy. Like when she sees like her granddaughter, like walk out of the, like when they're praying and she like sort of has a smile on her face. Right.
Yep.
So I wonder if this is just a thing like she forgets about. And so this is a thing that I think
part of the tragedy of like dementia, you know, having like experienced this one firsthand, like, yeah, it's rough. Right. And I think that we'll probably see different facets of that explored with this character, like in place with Jeb's mom, like firmly cased in their home. Right. Like we're going to have to deal with this. And I don't know.
So Jeb goes to take a shower. Rebecca joins him. Nice moment. And we get sort of flashes of a bunch of different things. So we're seeing like flashes of the case, Alan, flashbacks to the writing of the Book of Mormon. And Jeb asks Rebecca, what if some outside force has found its way here? What if tonight is the first edge of a bone that's finally working its way out of our desert's floor? And that is where we leave the episode.
So clearly he's evoking a parable. I should have done better homework. I'm going to. So when we come back next time, I want to like talk about that. But this is like the words of a parable. It's got to be right. Like not knowing it off the top of my head, we could imagine what it's about. That like the bone protruding from like the sand could stab you at the bottom of your foot. You could walk through like the sand without kind of foot sheathing in a lot of like conditions. But that hidden thing stabbing at you. What if this evil emerges from this idyllic kind of like, you know, beachside that we're looking at. I don't know.
When I search that specific phrase, I get a lot of Andrew Garfield's show is pretty good.
Yeah.
A lot of what I'm getting. So
Well, that's even better if it's like written to evoke the energy of a parable, right? If Jeb is like speaking in his own kind of like extemporaneous modern day, like eulogizing or whatever, proselytizing, it's very well put. But again, it's just more of this, like he's just desperately grasping for anything that will let him hold on to the belief it's outside his church. Like the idea that he's going to have to reconcile with the deep inner workings of his church, with people that are prestigious, respected, renowned amidst his community, amidst his religion, when the seemingly like much of the entirety of Jeb's identity revolves around his faith and his representative as like a member of the church. Right. And for an individual like that to be challenged in that way is jarring. Right. So I think he's like grasping, Grace.
I'm going to tell you something. I was a little bit worried about it. I mean, this show was getting very good reviews. I like Andrew Garfield. I sometimes have this thing with certain actors. I've said this a lot about The Rock, where I'm like, I can't watch you in a movie and not see you as The Rock.
Yeah.
So he'll be like, he's in like Jungle Cruise. He's like, my name is Frank. Yeah. And I'm like, no, it's not. Your name is The Rock.
Your name's Frank The Rock Johnson.
And I kind of feel sometimes that way about Andrew Garfield.
I get it.
I don't think I was as high on his performance in Tick, Tick, Boom. And like, I can recognize that he's good, and I also can't get out of my head, like, I'm watching Andrew Garfield.
You put that suit on, and I'm not like, that's Peter Parker. Like, Andrew Garfield is Spider-Man. That's so cool. Yeah. So, multiverse.
I was a little bit worried heading into this. And again, I joked about like him being having a little bit of a baby face. He's going to be like this like dad, whatever. Right. I think the end here, I think this line was like, what if tonight is the first edge of a bone that's finally working its way out of our desert's floor? While he's saying that to his wife that he is like sharing with, I think a lesser actor, this line is ridiculous. I think lesser actor has this line. It doesn't work, but
no.
It works. Credit to Garfield, credit to the writer of this episode, which is Dustin Lance Black, and the director David McKenzie here, because I think this was good, and I thought it was overall a really good episode and a really strong premiere. So
I fully agree as well. Right now, all I could hear is Josh reading that line in an Arnold Schwarzenegger impression.
Yeah.
Not to suggest Josh is a lesser.
What if tonight is the first edge of a bone that's finally working its way out of our desert floor?
What if some outside force has found its way here?
I think it's actually some outside evil. I think I misinterpreted the line. I think I just wrote the line. Some outside evil. This felt
one of its edge of its bone walking up out of the desert floor.
Okay, here's a Patreon incentive level perk, Philly.
Yes.
Let's we'll pitch Josh on the exact number, but if you get X number of patrons, Josh reads like scripts from movies and TV shows, but only as Arnold Schwarzenegger.
As Arnold.
He's like Arnold.
I feel like we don't need that many more patrons to get Josh to do this. But if you're interested,
Josh,
sign up.
Oh, we got to bump it up way high.
Next week, we're going to come back with a number. So you guys should all be like signing up at the $10 a month level. Patreon.com/postshowrecaps. $10 a month. Get into the Discord at Josh Wiggler that you want him as Arnold to read Shakespeare. Yeah.
If you like this idea, if you could tag at Round Howard and then maybe hashtag Arnold Table Read, I think might
process
be
too much.
Yeah, hashtag Arnold Table Read is what we'll go with for now. That'll be the name of the
Yorick.
Yeah. So it'll just be Arnold Schwarzenegger as every character from every TV show. It'll be every week, so that'll be great.
What have we done?
I don't know. we've invented two games. So we've invented a new patron party, and we played Robert Cornish. His role? Yeah,
this is an unambiguously successful pilot podcast. I think the pilot episode of Under the Banner of Heaven was really good. I'm like very interested. I'm going to try to do my due diligence along the way here and do a little bit of homework while being like thoughtful about like investigating the case itself. But I want to know a little bit more and like, I'm curious to this examination. Yeah,
I think that if you end up doing some digging around and this is a true story. We struggled with this with Winning Time, a show based on real life events where, it was like, should I spoil something? Cause it actually happened in real life. So I don't feel like I'm spoiling it, but I actually am. Cause some people might be engaging with the content of the show for the first time.
Yes.
I think if we did some digging and I accidentally see like, oh, I know, like, I don't know. I think it'll be okay. We'll do our best to not like try to spoil it, but we might end up in the future episodes giving a little bit of like, you might need to skip ahead 2 minutes if you're really spoiler averse, just in case I do some digging around. But this show has been a really strong premiere. I'm excited. This episode, I did not mention this, and as I often forget to do, was called When God Was Love, which I think makes sense with a lot of what Alan was talking about. And next episode is called Rightful Place. So excited to see what that means. Yeah.
Yep. Was a delight. Was a very good time. I'm really excited to dig into episode 2 and to sit down with you to discuss it.
If you have feedback, patreon.com/postshowrecaps. You can hit us up in the Patreon Discord, or we are both on Twitter. Philly, why don't you give out some plugs?
I got a bunch of plugs. On Twitter, I am at DM Philly. You can find me there. You can talk to me about Star Wars or Under the Banner of Heaven. I just finished podcasting about Outer Range. What was the name of this episode again, Grace?
When God Was Love.
Which is an enormous theme in conclusion of season 1 of Outer Range. So you should check it out. It's really interesting. It was a fascinating show. Josh Brolin kills it. Really, one of the most exciting things for me about it was sitting down with Austin Smith to talk about it every week. So there's a whole backlog of podcasts for you guys to dig into there.
Delighted to hear Austin on some podcasts because he is a tremendously smart individual.
You are not kidding.
So, yes.
Austin is like exceptional, and I was delighted to like get to share the space with them. We need to do that again. You can find me and Grace streaming a bunch of Dungeons and Dragons on Twitch.tv/DM Philly. This is where we on Tuesday nights get together. We play D&D in space. Dragonfly is our fun D&D in space campaign. Every couple of weeks we get together and you play a raccoon, Grace, with a little pet snail who's on a wild adventure through the forest with your furry companions.
Hey, in Dragonfly, I play a very religious character.
True.
So
religion, enormous theme on twitch.tv/DM Philly on Dragonfly. That's mostly just I'm getting ready to like fire up the X-Wings with Mike Bloom and Latanya Starks for us to start talking about Obi-Wan here at the end of the month. That's it. That's me. That's most of me.
Cool. I have a bunch of stuff going on. I'm just going to name some shows. And if you watch any of them, check out my Twitter and you can check them out. So Winning Time, HBO show, finished coverage of Russian Doll, The Wilds, currently covering Shining Girls, covered Heartstopper on Netflix. And I cover movies every week with Ariel, although we're on a tiny bit of a 2-week hiatus. We'll be back soon with our coverage of Firestarter, the Stephen King adaptation and remake of a previous Firestarter movie.
Drew Barry.
You do? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Jess Sterling was very creeped out by Drew Barrymore on the cover of the poster.
She was terrifying.
Yeah. And then over on Rob is a podcast. I cover sports on with the Off Speed podcast this week. Very excited. Somebody who plays in the Humble Year game, Aiden, is going to be joining me to talk about hurling, an Irish Gaelic sport. So that will be fun. And Mike Bloom, I'm going to help him pick a new baseball team. Not new. I don't think he has ever had a baseball team. So I'm going to help him pick a baseball team. That should be very fun.
Oh, nice. Any,
yeah. Anything else I'm doing, you can follow me on Twitter at High From Grace, and I will let you know about it. Mostly in the form of a retweet. I think that is our coverage for the first episode of Under the Banner of Heaven. I don't know. Do we have an outro, Rich? Do we have? I don't know. I should have thought about it before.
I definitely didn't think about it. The outro is the hardest part. I got nothing for you, Grace. Well,
all right. We'll be back in a few days. Bye.